Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the editor of the New Books Network. NBN listeners like to read books and buy them. So we thought we'd tell you that right now, our friends at Princeton University Press are having a remarkable site-wide sale. You can get 50% off books, including ebooks and audiobooks, with the code 50, F-I-F-T-Y, at checkout until May 31. You can save some real money on Princeton University Press books. I encourage you to go there and check it out.
This is New Books in Political Science. My name is Heath Brown. Today I have the real good pleasure of speaking with Jeffrey Hennig, who is the author of The End of Exceptionalism in American Education, The Changing Politics of School Reform. I hope you enjoy this interview. Welcome to New Books in Political Science. My name is Heath Brown, and I have the real pleasure to talk with Jeff Hennig today, the author of The End of Exceptionalism in American Education, The Changing Politics of School Reform. Jeff, how are you doing?
I'm fine, Heath. How are you?
Wonderful. I know a lot about who you are, but I always like to give people the chance to give a little bit of the background on, you know, what came before the publication of their new book. And so what's the snapshot of where you are now and what you're doing?
Well, sure. I started as a political scientist. My first position, where I met you, Heath, was at George Washington University, where I was in the Department of Political Science. And my focus originally was urban politics generally, without much of a attention to education, in particular. But over time, I increasingly became interested in education policy, education politics. And about, almost 11 years ago now, I moved from George Washington up to Teachers College at Columbia, where I've run a politics and education program at Teachers College, and I'm also a member of the political science department at Columbia.
Yeah, I find it absolutely shocking that that's been that long. It's just about every publication I have, every job I've had ever since GW has been, you know, a result of your mentoring and work, and so I call upon another favor for you today to talk about your book. And so it was a real enjoyable book to read. And one that I have the feeling in reading it that this was your effort to write something big about school reform. You know, though the book isn't long, the scope and breadth feels substantial. I wonder if this was your intention and whether this is how you pitched the book to the publisher.
Well, I backed into the issue of the end of exceptionalism. I had written about mayoral control of schools quite a bit, and mayoral control of schools, when you sort of get away from the sort of hot politics of the moment and think about what it means structurally, involved shifting key decisions from elected school boards and from governance institutions that were particular to schools, superintendents and school board members, into arenas where general purpose politicians like mayors, who have a lot of other things to think about besides just schools, are calling the shots. I wrote and thought about mayoral control just on its own terms for a while until I was asked by a former colleague, Dorothy Schiff, to write a chapter about mayors, governors and presidents, education governors and education presidents. And it was while I was really working through that chapter that I began to think more about the fact that this shift, first of all, from general purpose to school, from school specific to general purpose institutions, was multi-level, that this wasn't something that you could account for just by looking at what was going on in particular cities like Boston or New York or whatever. But also, you know, began to realize that even though the attention often goes to the executives, to mayors and governors and presidents, because they're the high profile actors, that as education was migrating into these new arenas, legislatures also became more involved. And that, you know, that kind of big, broad focus on structural change in the education landscape, I think, you know, as I wrestled with it, I realized it was pretty new to me to frame it that way, and that's what encouraged me to try to work it out through a book.
Yeah, and you know, I've developed two kind of interests as I've been reading and working on this podcast program. And one is a real interest in titles. And the second interest is in these quotes that people often skip over right at the start of a chapter. I don't even know if these quotes have an actual name. But you start in chapter one with a quote from Bob Dylan. And without singing the lyric, the lyric is, and something is happening here, but you don't know what it is, do you, Mr. Jones? I wonder why you chose that quote. It's from what I gather, this is a song that is one of the high protest songs and is a real anti-establishment message to the song. Why this quote? What does it mean? How does it set up the start of the book?
Yeah, sure. Well, I wasn't sort of sneaking in an anti-war message, but there have been. I argue in the book that there have been at least three very broad structural shifts going on over the last several decades in American education, and two of them have gotten a lot of attention. One is the general shift within our federal system of substantial degree of decision-making authority up the ladder from local districts to states and the national government. The second is a shift to some considerable extent from public sector into private sector delivery systems, in particular in education, via vouchers and charter schools and the emergence of a large nonprofit charter management organization system, private testing companies and publishers and the like. Those two structural changes, which are very important, have gotten a lot of attention. The shift from school-specific to general-purpose government, I think, is of similar import, but has happened under most people's radar screen, partly because it's been slow and gradual. So I know I won't get the details right, but you know, there are experiments about what happens when you sort of throw a frog into a boiling pot of water versus when you sit a frog in a pot of water and slowly heat the water. And when change is gradual, it often just escapes notice. So those frogs who get thrown into the boiling water jump out as quick as they can, and the ones sitting there while the water slowly heats up to boiling stay too long. And it's that part of the Dylan quote. Mm-hmm. There's been things that people have noticed. Teachers' unions notice that they don't have the clout that they used to have, for example. Ideas that have been prevalent in other parts of domestic policy, ideas like contracting out with private providers, like performance management systems generally, those ideas have all of a sudden gotten entry into education debates where for years they did not. And my argument is those things that shift in who has influence at the core and the shift in the kinds of policy approaches that have credibility is at least in large measure explained by this broader governance shift.
And getting to this relates to the title of the book and this idea of exceptionalism, which is not the same meaning that others have for either American exceptionalism or American education exceptionalism. What's the particular use that you're using here?
Yeah, sure. So as you and most of your listeners know, I'm sure the term American exceptionalism is often used to make the point that the U.S. is somehow different from other developed countries. Often, at least in a politically charged manner, it's used to assert that the U.S. is better in some ways, and key values or institutions or ways of going about things. I'm not talking about that at all. What I'm talking about is education as having been dealt differently from other domestic policy decisions, at least the major ones, which have been historically dealt with by general purpose government. So social welfare policy, transportation policy, housing policy, science policy, these things have been dealt with and we expect to be dealt with by bodies like Congress or state legislatures that are not expert in all respects, that have to, you know, not only make decisions and draw priorities around things that they don't know everything about, but they also are accustomed to negotiating and doing trade-offs across different kinds of policies as they put together an overall, you know, agenda to pursue. And that's what education is becoming like, but has not been like, especially at the local level, where education decisions not only were made and still are for the most part made by separate school boards rather than city councils, often with a dedicated revenue stream, which can come from property taxes or whatever, but so that the money doesn't have to be traded off across multiple purposes. Often the elections of school boards are deliberately set at a different time from the elections of city council members and mayors and governors and presidents. So the electorate for those elections is a different one from the general electorate. That's been an important part of American history. We somehow, you know, we fell into it without some broad, you know, theoretical rationale for doing so. But it affected the development of education for many decades, in a way that was different from what was going on elsewhere. And my argument in the book is that difference has been eroded, that education is being reabsorbed into general purpose governments, not to the point where I expect school boards and school districts and state boards of education to disappear or to be pushed totally to the margin, but just in a substantial way, they have less clout and less influence than they once did.
Yeah, and along those lines, had the chance to talk to Jesse Rhodes, who wrote this book, I guess, about 6 months ago, about No Child Left Behind. And he writes particularly about the emergence of a lot of sort of the preceding policy innovations that came before No Child Left Behind. He writes about that education governors, particularly these southern governors that emerged in the 1980s and 90s, and you write about the education governor, and you have a way in which you are able to identify who is and who isn't. I wonder if you'd just talk briefly about, you know, how you identified who is an education governor and what the analysis says about this larger thesis related to identifying education governors.
Sure. Well, you know, there's different ways that people have approached this, and actually I try to approach it several ways. Two of them are more traditional, and one I kind of made up on my own.
Mm-hmm.
So the two that are more traditional are to look at the formal powers of the governor. So some governors have more formal powers over education. They get to appoint the school board, the state board of education, for example, or even appoint the state chief state school officer, the equivalent of state superintendent, whereas other governors don't have that formal power. So one concept is education governors are those with the formal power. Another one is, and this is the way it's used more typically, and I think in your discussion with Professor Rhodes, this is more the notion of governors who were, you know, educational entrepreneurs or political entrepreneurs. They spotted an opportunity to use education and education issues as a way to distinguish themselves as candidates and governors. And that's largely a measure of kind of just visibility and involvement. I wanted to get beyond the formal measures because it's pretty clear that some active governors don't have unusually strong formal powers, and some governors with strong formal powers don't use them. But I wanted to do it in a way where I could, at least in very broad stroke, look through the whole of American history, and that's very tricky. So what we did is we took advantage of the fact that the National Governors Association has compiled short bios of every governor ever. And we went into those descriptions in those bios and looked to see which governors were mentioned as having accomplished something in terms of education. And these are bios of 2-3 paragraphs. So for education to work its way in there, it's got to have been at least a fairly prominent part of what they did in office. And it's out of the coding of that that I'm able to come up with a rough indicator of the changes over time and the extent to which governors focused on education, and across states, whether some states have had historically more active governors in education than others, and finally to look at the extent to which the this kind of, you know, involvement in their of education, their agenda aligns with their formal powers or not.
And the trend seems to be an increase. So the empirical evidence that you collect is that, in fact, this is increasing over the last couple of decades.
Yeah, that's right. Now, I wouldn't, you know, hinge my whole story on that method. I had fun with that indicator. I think it's a useful indicator. It has limits, but, you know, it's confirmed by the fact that when you look at formal governor's powers, you know, which are codified in law, and so you can find them in a more straightforward and reliable way, you know, that those also show a growing role of gubernatorial power. In the mail control literature, folks who write about that are used to, you know, defining this very simply and clearly by whether the mayor appoints the school board members. But we've been, even earlier than mayoral control emerged as kind of a newer form in the early 90s, a number of states had begun giving governors more formal control and selecting their state boards of education. So just by analogy, that kind of shift in authority has been going on forever.
Right. Yeah, and so we have this big shift, the central thesis of the book. And there are some winners and losers here. And you have a chapter on sort of the actors, the policy actors who have risen to the top in this, and I think part of your argument is not that the other actors have been completely displaced, but there's now a richer array of different actors in the mix, as they would say. So, but I think there are some winners and losers in this. And so, who has won out from this shift that you describe, and whose power or influence maybe has been pushed aside a little bit?
Yeah, sure. And you know, some of this, and we can get to this in a second, may evolve and change over time, but initially, there's no question that this shift has weakened to a certain extent the advantages that historically teachers, unions, and organized parents have had in school decisions. In these smaller school-specific arenas, teachers, unions were able to wield disproportionate influence because they could concentrate on and in some instances elect, you know, school board members who were sympathetic to their views, and activist parents are the ones who, along with teachers, would show up at these elections, for example, these off-cycle elections where there'd be very low turnout overall, but, you know, you could count on teachers and parents to be the ones pulling the levers. Now those teachers and parents are still very concerned about education, but they've got to compete in arenas in which other folks who care about other things are also asking for the attention of policymakers and for a piece of a finite public sector pie. Now, the winners, it's a little bit trickier to address, but I think one of the winners, at least so far, have been private sector organizations, for-profit organizations, and not-for-profit organizations that sell services or contract with government to provide services in a wide array of areas. Historically, we've turned slowly to contracting with private providers to provide services. For years, education was the laggard, and now we're beginning to see those kind of groups gain entry, and they gain entry partly as providers of education services, a charter school, for example, or an organization that might provide professional development training for teachers, or supplemental education services, tutoring for kids on the weekend. They enter as providers of education, but they also enter as political activists, because they can and often do organize politically to exert influence, just like other interest groups do.
Yeah, and you highlight in that chapter also the work that Sarah Reckow has done on philanthropic foundations. I had the chance to talk to her last week, and that fits very nicely into some of the story that you're telling about the role that they're playing and they've played the last few decades. Well,
that's right, and you know, there's a whole, both by the fact that they've been dealing with one another over time, but also by language and inclination and existing access channels, these private provider foundations and the nonprofit and for-profit providers have, generally speaking, found mayors and governors and presidents to be easier to approach and more open to their attempts at influence, and more comfortable with their way of framing the issues than they do elected school boards, which these groups often see as somewhat parochial and highly protective of the traditional ways of doing things.
Right. But, you know, but in the end, you're not a pessimist about school reform. And you end the book on that note. So what makes you optimistic? What is the optimism that you see in what for some people is sort of a direction that they aren't terribly comfortable with? What makes you optimistic?
Sure. Well, I mean, let me first say that whether I'm optimistic or pessimistic depends on which side of the bed I get up on in the morning.
Okay.
Half the time I get up on the pessimistic side, and then I'm nervous about the fact that advocates of public education and public investment in education are losing an edge that they once held, and that could come at a cost that's significant. But I do, you're right, you swing around to an optimistic view in the book, and it's a view that goes this way. In order to simply survive and compete in these new arenas, education advocates are going to have to learn to engage more in multi-issue coalitions, learn to frame their vision and articulate their goals in ways that appeal to and find common ground with people who care about other issues, whether it's, you know, global warming or social services or whatnot, to explain to them what the links are between education and how these things can reinforce one another. So it's out of necessity, but I also think it could be for the good. And that's because if you believe, as I do, that the way to really address educational needs in the country, and in particular those related to gaps based on income and race and place, we need to pull lever occurs beyond those that just exist in school districts and in schools. We need to have a multi-sector approach for dealing with these problems. So out of the necessity of having to build these multi-issue coalitions, I think may come a more coherent and ultimately effective education policy.
Jeff Hennig is the author of The End of Exceptionalism in American Education, The Changing Politics of School Reform. Jeff, thank you very much for your time today.